Some years ago, there was a man called Timothy Evans, a single man who could neither read nor write. In 1947, at the age of 22, he married Beryl Thorley. The following year, their only child, Geraldine, was born. A year later, November the 8th, 1949, Beryl was strangled and then raped. 2 days later, baby Geraldine was also murdered. Evans was arrested, tried, and found guilty. And Mr. Justice Lewis put on the black cap and sentenced Evans to be hanged. And on March the 9th, 1950, confused, dim-witted, illiterate Timothy Evans was executed at Pentonville Prison. But he wasn't guilty. He'd only been convicted on the evidence of a man called John Christie, who lived in the flat beneath. It was, in fact, Christie who had killed Beryl and Geraldine, and indeed six other women. In 1953, Christie was caught and executed for the murder of his own wife, and it was then that the horror began to dawn on press and politicians alike that an innocent person had been executed. It took 13 years for officialdom to admit the improbability of two mass murderers living in the same building. In July 1965, 113 MPs demanded an inquiry, and a posthumous free pardon was eventually granted to Timothy Evans. When something like that happens, the whole world gasps in horror at the injustice. We can't believe that such a thing could happen, for it did happen. Then when we come to the event that divides our whole history into two, the event of the cross, and we see the amazement of what took place. The purest, holiest being who ever walked on this earth, the person who's the example for the whole of the human race, is that this is the standard you can rise to. And on a completely trumped-up charge, is arrested. And with false witnesses bumping against each other, colliding, unable to agree, nevertheless still handed over to be put to death by the cruelest means then known, we gasp. The strange thing is we also rejoice. I was once explaining the cross to somebody, and they said, how can you ever be happy if you put your trust in Jesus Christ when he's done that, when that's happened to him? I said, that's the extraordinary thing about it. It isn't, we have a joy running through us, not the kind of joy you see in a football stadium when you jump up and down, because it's too deep for that. So you see it sometimes in the Holy Communion. Or I think of a friend of mine I met with 4 weeks ago, in Kenya, called Stephen Lungu, who's going to come and preach here in September. He had been a terrorist. He'd been sent to blow up a gathering of 1,000 people in Zimbabwe by the gang that he represented. And the strange thing was, it was a Christian meeting, and he became a Christian at the very meeting he was sent to blow up. And afterwards, he describes in his joy at being forgiven by the crucified Christ how he stood out in a field and he hung on to a tree in his new conversion. And he said, God, can you see me? I'm holding on to this tree. I'm hugging this tree. If it was you here, I'd be hugging you for joy and gratitude. Strange, but that's what the cross does. We gasp at the injustice of it, but it also is the key to our joy, our well-being, forever. So here we are at the center of all things in this passage. The crucifixion. They meet a man called Simon from Cyrene. And who is this man, Simon? Well, they force him to carry the cross. He is one of those involved against his will. They forced him to do it. He's from Cyrene, and it seems that there was a synagogue of Cyrenians at Jerusalem. We know that from Acts chapter 6 and verse 9. So maybe he'd been at the synagogue, or he had something to do with the synagogue. He's a man of Jewish background. And they find this man from Cyrene and say, go on, you carry the prisoner's cross. He's too weak to hold it. So he holds the cross, carries it. And later, it seems, it has done something to Simon of Cyrene. Again, we know that, I think, because of Mark chapter 15, verse 21, the parallel passage, where they add the little extra bit of information. He was the father of Alexander and Rufus. So who is this father of two Christian men? Well, no doubt he had become a Christian himself. He was known in the church. He's known by name, and his children are known by name to the early church. It seems to me that what happened to Simon of Cyrene was that the event probably compelled him to stay on and see what was happening. Who was this strange prisoner? And then as the impact of the cross dawned upon him, it was a meeting place for him. And he's able then to convey the message, to explain the message to his children, who then themselves become members of the church. That's my supposition of it. It's an event of irony and agony in this passage here. They come to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. You can visit that place today, at least what people suppose to be the place. There's a place in Jerusalem which they still, to this very day and all through history, they've called Skull Hill. And my belief is that it was there, must have been there, I think, that the crucifixion took place. And when we try and imagine the agony of it, of the worst form of death that had been devised within the Roman Empire. People didn't like to speak about crucifixion as a terrible thing. It is an appalling thing. We may not know, we cannot tell, we were singing a moment ago, we don't know. What was the worst thing about the crucifixion? We don't know. We just don't know. Whether it was the sheer agony of the nails through hands and feet, whether it was the fact of being stripped and exposed to the human gaze, passers-by, the casuals, whoever, whether it was the flies, whether it was the sheer heat of the sunshine beating down upon you, and therefore the agonizing thirst that would result. What was it? Or was it the mocking? We don't know. We may not know. We're not allowed to know. And then there's the extra burden, it seems, of the sins of the whole of the human race bearing down upon that lonely figure upon the cross, so that he cries out in his agony. Somebody is kind to him. They offered Jesus wine to drink. The soldiers did that, part of their soldiers' rations, and the prisoner won't take it. It seems that he's determined that he's going to go through the agony to its full extent. When they crucify him, they divide up his clothes by casting lots. And again, the irony of it. Did they not realize what was happening? The fulfilling of the prophecy way back in Psalm 22, where there is described for us in full the punishment of a man for something that he never did. A sort of Timothy Evans figure, the psalmist, writing of this figure. There it is in verse 18. They divide my garments among them. They cast lots for my clothing. Didn't they realize, the onlookers, as the clothes were being divided up, and let's toss dice for the clothes. You'll have that, okay, I'll have that. Didn't they realize that it was the fulfilling of a prophecy? I suppose it just didn't dawn on them. They may have read that in the Psalms, Psalm 22, verse 18, didn't dawn on them. Or the fulfilling of the prophecies of Isaiah. Tremendous irony here. And then, as we think of the fact of the cross, and there it is standing there with the two robbers each side, all being crucified together. It seems to me that it was a real cross in the sense of the traditional form of the cross that we understand it in. It wasn't a St. Andrew's cross-shaped in that way, nor was it a T-shaped cross, as some theologians have suggested. Verse 37 tells me the answer. Above his head they placed the written charge against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. So above his head is that inscription. So there had to be, therefore, the top of the cross to carry that inscription. The gospel writers are a little bit divided as to the exact form of the inscription. Well, that's understandable because it was written in three different languages. So which particular translation we're reading here, we're not quite sure. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Again, the irony of it. It was put there, up there as a jest, and as a gesture of defiance from Pilate to fling the insult into the face of the Jews. This is your king. But he never spoke a truer word. The dereliction of the cross, we may not know. We cannot tell what pains he had to bear. And then again, as we think of Psalm 22 and verse 7 and 8, all who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Did not those who took part in the fist waving and the head wagging at the figure on the lonely cross there, didn't they understand that they were fulfilling prophecy as well? For there it is. Verse 39, those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself, come down from the cross, if you are the Son of God. He saved others, verse 42, but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross. Then we'll believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. It's just an exact tie-up with the prophecies. And yet they didn't realize it. The penny didn't drop. The agony of it and the irony of it. And then I seem to detect three classes of sinner in this particular episode. There are the ignorant sinners, there are the religious sinners, and there are the condemned sinners. They're all there meeting at the cross. So Simon of Cyrene, he's had his moment there at the cross, and it seems to have made a difference to his future. Yes, it does. Even just to have a brush with the cross means that God meets us there. He will meet us there. There was a vicar years ago in the Church of England called Charles Simeon. He was vicar of Holy Trinity, Cambridge. He became that in 1783. He had a long time at Cambridge, many years, but in his earliest several years, many years in fact, he was ostracized, hated. Every possible kind of obstruction was put in the way of him preaching in Holy Trinity. The authorities didn't like it, and those who did want to hear him couldn't even get into the church because it would be locked by the people in charge, the authorities. And then when it was finally unlocked and people could get in, they couldn't get into the seats because the seats, they were kind of box pews, and they had locks on them, and they were deliberately locked. So no one could sit to listen to the sermon. So you had to stand in the aisle to listen to the sermon. This went on for year after year after year, Charles Simeon. He had a very, very rough time indeed. He was a faithful man, preached the cross. The congregation grew and grew and grew. People responded to the preaching. But he found it extremely hard work to be hated as he was. Once in a conversation with a Mr. Gurney, he said this, and I quote, "Many years ago, when I was an object of much contempt and derision in this university, I strolled forth one day, buffeted and afflicted, with my little testament in my hand. I prayed earnestly to my God that he would comfort me with some cordial from his word, and that on opening the book I might find some text which would sustain me. The first text that caught my eye was this. They found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to carry his cross. You know, Simon is the same name as Simeon. What a world of instruction was here. What a blessed hint for my encouragement. To have the cross laid upon me, that I might bear it after Jesus. What a privilege. It was enough. Now I could leap and sing for joy as one whom Jesus was honoring with a participation in his sufferings. That's Charles Simeon. So again, he sets an example for other people around the world who find it hard to be a follower of Jesus Christ, because in a sense they're carrying his cross. They're having a share in the condemnation that the world heaps upon the crucified one. We shall find it. We do find it as we put our trust in Christ. The New Testament never says, oh, admire the cross, applaud it, isn't it wonderful? It doesn't say that. It says, carry it. You're going to have a share. You're going to be part of this if you're going to be a believer at all. And it may not be easy. And yet, there's joy as well mixed in. That's the extraordinary thing. There are the ignorant sinners here, then, I was saying. The passers-by. So there they are. Verse 39, those who passed by hurled insults at him. They're having a good time. It's part of the show, shaking their heads. You're going to destroy the temple, we heard. Oh, look, what are you going to do now? The ignorant sinners, they didn't really know anything about it. If we'd been there and we were among them, would we have done the same? I bet we would. I think we would. I think we would have probably said to ourselves, look, there's been so much trouble with this man. We want a bit of peace in Jerusalem. Maybe it's for the best if he's removed. Perhaps it's for the best in the end. And again, there are others who like to choose a colorful rogue rather than a holy man. So that's why they chose Barabbas, not Jesus, when the choice is put to them by Pilate, which you'd like to have. If we'd been there, what would we have done? If you chose a football crowd today and said, who would you like to choose now? Who's going to be your hero? This person of holy, upright living, a wonderful man who never speaks wrong, always good, generous, or you're going to choose this colorful rogue, who would the football crowd go for? They'd go for the colorful rogue. I guess we would. We'd say, you know, he may be a bit of a rascal, but, you know, he's got character. We'll go for him. Wonderful. That's what we would do. We'd have been the same, ignorant sinners. Then there were the religious sinners. There they are. The same way, verse 41, the chief priests and the teachers of the law and the elders, they mock him. He saved others. He can't save himself. He's the king of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross. We'll believe in him. There's one thing that he wouldn't do. If he was going to be the true Messiah, then the whole role depicted for the Messiah was of a suffering Messiah. So to be the Messiah, he had to stay there. He did stay there. Didn't the religious people realize that they were fulfilling prophecy in these words? They didn't really. Theirs was perhaps the more evil way. Religious sinners. Blaise Pascal of the 17th century wrote this, men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from religious conviction. I think we agree with that. As we look around our world today, the world of religion, often we see the most hideous things being done cheerfully by people in the name of religion. Religious sinners. Then there were the condemned sinners, the robbers. It says there in verse 44, in the same way the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. They took part as well. Ignorant sinners, religious sinners, condemned sinners. Yes, they were guilty, but they take part also in the scorn and ridicule. The figure in the middle, accepting it all. He did that for us. And then one of the sinners, those condemned sinners, one of the robbers repents, we know that. One of the soldiers repents, that's the centurion. We know that he turns, says, truly this was the Son of God. There's Simeon. It seems that he is affected. The cross is a meeting place. And that's what we learn from this whole episode, the cross, is the one place where God will meet with people. He won't meet with you anywhere else. You may say, well, wouldn't he meet with me through piling up my good deeds against my bad deeds? No. There's only one place that God will meet with you. That's at the cross. He won't meet with you anywhere else. I'll meet with you there, he says, but nowhere else. So how can we meet with God? How can we know him? Come to the cross. You come there and we say, like the man who hugged the tree, you say, I am guilty. But thank you for forgiving me. If you were here, this is what I would do to you. I'd hug you. Thank you for dying for me. Thank you for forgiving me. Thank you for giving me eternal life. It all happened at one place, at the cross, where I allowed you to bear my sins and their righteous reward instead of me. So it's a point to ponder as we go and break for lunch in a moment. And if you want to ponder further, take one of my little books. I don't often do this, but I wrote a little book called Recognizing Jesus. Take this book. Let it be your kind of lead up to Easter. Use the prayer, if you like, on the back page that I've written out, which explains, it says, thank you for dying for me upon the cross to take upon yourself the responsibility for the sins of all the world. Let me be among the company of those who are forgiven through the power of your death. The prayer goes on. Make that your prayer. You can take it away. It won't cost you anything. I'll put a little heap of them at the back of the, on the last seat at the back. All right, just pick one up and then make that prayer your own. Steal your own moment if you've never done it before. For God says, I'll meet you at one place only, at the cross. We have a prayer. We cannot be the same, O Lord, once we have seen the cross and what it does. Fill us with that holy joy and deep sense of thanksgiving as we come to the cross, some of us initially for the first time, and others of us coming back to it again and yet again, for the assurance of sins forgiven and for the reminder that you love us and hold us forever. We ask this for your name's sake. Amen.